This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, there is so much in the news and so much I want to share with you today. We've got a huge show organized for the day. In our second hour, Professor Richard Wolff is going to drop by. We're going to be talking about, what's going on with the markets and what capitalism is, you know, how this works. What is it doing to us? In our third hour, Congressmember Karen Bass is going to be with us. She is going to be the new incoming head of the Black Congressional Caucus, Congressional Black Caucus. Just a quick heads up of something, you know, for your activism, kind of an activism alert here. Kathy Kraninger is a woman who has been working in the Trump administration. She participated in the zero tolerance policy that led to family separations on the border and the detention of immigrant children. She had oversight of parts of the response to Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico, both apparently complete disasters. She has no experience as a consumer advocate. She has no experience with consumer finance. And Mick Mulvaney wants to put her in charge of the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. A right-wing Trump hack. And the Senate is going to vote today on confirming her. So you may want to call your senator. The number is 202-225-3121. You may want to call your senator and say, hey, vote no on Kathy Kraninger today for the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. Or just vote no on that woman who they want to put in charge of the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, or that person, if you want to make it gender neutral. This is not a good thing for consumers in America. Meanwhile, Huawei is a company that probably you've not heard about. Most Americans don't know much about Huawei. Huawei, H-U-A-W-E-I, is a Chinese company. It's the second largest manufacturer of cell phones in the world. And they also manufacture equipment that facilitates cell phone communication, the stuff that you use in the back office for 3G, 4G, and 5G networks. And the concern that the United States has been sharing since the Obama administration is that Huawei is building back doors into their phones and into their communications equipment so that the government of China can spy on the communications of everybody using a Huawei phone. Or any of the phone companies that are using Huawei equipment. Now, there have been, arguments that that's the case. There have been arguments mostly made by Huawei that that's not the case, but, that's what's going on right now. And Huawei also apparently has been selling these cell phones into Iran, which is a violation of U.S. sanctions. So Meng Wanzhou, who is the daughter of the founder of Huawei and is now the chief financial officer, the number two person in the company, being groomed apparently to take over for her father. She's the oldest child of the founder. His name is Reng Zhenfei. She was in Canada yesterday, and she was arrested on a U.S. warrant for selling cell phones to Iran, apparently. We don't have all the details because most of these documents are not public. But this is just, gleaned from news reports. And China, she's being deported to the United States from Canada. And China is just having a fit over this. So if you are noticing that the stock market seems to be going down today, it may have something to do with this, too, in addition to just the broad, frightening incompetence of Donald Trump. But this is a big deal. And this has the potential. China has militarized the South China Sea. They are denying all the other countries in the area's historic right to the waters beyond their borders and saying, no, all these waters are ours. This could be a military confrontation. Donald Trump could be leading us to a war that none of us want. I mean, this could be really, really bad. Meanwhile, Republicans in the U.S. House of Representatives want to end the student loan debt forgiveness program that was put in place during the Obama administration. Why? Because it helps students. Screw the students. We want to help the banksters. That's the official motto of the Republican Party. Representatives Virginia Fox, Republican of North Carolina, and Brett Guthrie, Republican of Kentucky, have created this piece of legislation. It's called the PROSPER Act. Real opportunity, success, and prosperity through education reform. And when Republicans say reform, you know what it means. We're going to screw you. That's absolutely what it means. House Democrats, on the other hand, are promoting their College for All Act, which would make public colleges and universities tuition free. The Republicans want to make it more profitable for the student loan companies and harder for you to get out. The student loan forgiveness program has been taken advantage of by more than half a million, and in a good way, by more than half a million Americans. More than half a million Americans have signed up to have their student loans forgiven if they take a job that works in the public sector, in the public service, and work more than 100 and make more than 120 qualifying monthly payments over a period of 10 years. More than half a million borrowers have done this since 2007. Actually, this is a program that was started under George W. Bush. I thought it was Obama, but I see 2007 there. And what will be the consequences? Well, according to University of California Law School Professor Michael Simkovic, expected financing costs for students will likely increase to the detriment of both students and educational institutions. But, oh, the banks are going to be very happy. The bill would also start charging millions of low- and middle-income students interest on all of their loans while they're still in school, adding thousands of dollars to the students' loan balances. In other words, you're going to owe more money to your student debt company if the Republican law passes. This is Debbie Cochran, Vice President of the Institute for College Access Successes, where students are the losers under this proposal. The clear winners are for-profit colleges. By gutting regulations designed to ensure that schools provide the education students have paid for, this bill would have the taxpayers write a blank check to colleges that overcharge and underdeliver. This is just one more example. You know, the mask is being pulled off. And my question for you in this hour is, How far do you think this has gone? The awakening of America to the perfidy, to the lies, to the scam that is the Republican Party. I mean, how many Republicans do you know in your life who have awakened and said, you know, I get it now. The Republicans are all about the money. They're all about the banksters. They're all about the big greedy corporations. They're all about the dividends. They're all about the stock market. The Republicans don't give a rat's ass about wages. They don't give a rat's ass about Social Security or Medicare. In fact, they just assumed that Social Security was taken over by the big banks in New York and Medicare was taken over by the big insurance companies, both of which make giant contributions to Republicans and the Republican Party. How long is it going to take for the rest of America to wake up? I mean, we're still seeing elections that are being decided 50-50. Right? How long is it going to take? And are your Republican friends waking up? You know, some of mine are, I can tell you. And this, you know, just another example here. North Carolina. This is bizarre. In North Carolina, state representative David Lewis, the Republican who chairs the Elections Committee, filed a bill in the North Carolina House of Representatives day before yesterday. Keep in mind, this is the state where this alleged vote election fraud happened. And the bill is like, this is kind of weird language, right? Here's the language of the bill. In the even-numbered year, the chair shall be the member of the political party with the second highest number of registered affiliates. Now, what does that mean? What they're saying is that in odd-numbered years, this is what this legislation says, the people who are in charge of all of the elections in the state would change every year, the chair, the person in charge. On odd-numbered years, it would be a person who is appointed by the political party that has the most number of registered voters. Well, North Carolina, the Democrats, has been for a long time and will be for a long time. More Democrats registered to vote in North Carolina. So that means in the odd-numbered years, a Democrat would run the elections in North Carolina at the local level, all across the state, every single place. And in the even-numbered years, a Republican would run the elections. Now, what happens in even-numbered years in the United States? We have elections. Just, you know, think about it, 1980, 82, 84, you know, to 2018, 2016, 2014. In even-numbered years, we have elections. In odd-numbered years, we don't. So the Republicans in North Carolina are pushing legislation that would say that on the years that we have elections, Republicans are running the elections. On the years that we don't have elections, Democrats get to run the elections. There's something fundamentally wrong with this. This goes back to this, you know, have your friends figured out yet that the Republican Party is a scam? Sean Hannity. This is hysterical. He posted on Twitter, in all caps, "Christmas is under siege." What's the siege? Well, St. Susanna Parish in Dedham, Massachusetts, put a baby Jesus on their nativity scene inside a dog crate, basically, a 2 by 3 foot dog cage, a cage. And the pastor told the local news outlet when they were asked about it, when he was asked about it, he said, 65 million refugees worldwide seeking a better way of life, and we were wondering what that might look like 2,000 years ago if this family encountered the same dynamics that are taking place in our country right now. This is Reverend Steve Jashoma told the station. So what does Hannity say? This is hysterical. "Tonight on Hannity, we'll expose how Christmas is being politicized. Now Christmas is under siege. A Massachusetts church puts baby Jesus in a cage to make a political statement. Watch now." So on Twitter, there is some of the replies. This is from Jordan. He says, "How is it that you're more upset by a church pointing out what's happening at the border than you are about what's actually happening at the border?" Another, Chris Wernowski, says, "Please stop angering the people at my grandma's nursing home." Joe D. writes, "Tonight on Hannity, we'll be exposing how Christmas is being politicized by politicizing Christmas on Fox News." Dr. Bryson Wolf says, "So the church is doing a war on Christmas by reminding us that Jesus was a refugee, immigrant, and asylum seeker in his life. You remember that 'what you did for the least of my people' line, right? Seems like the war on Christ more than anything else, not a war on Christmas." Jeff Abbott tweeted, "Don't you have a Starbucks cup to be mad at?" Beal, "Relax, cowboy, it's not a real baby." Angela Martinez writes, "Christmas is just fine, it's families that are under siege." And then Scott says, "Brought to you by the network that has an annual War on Christmas 2-month special every year."
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
But we haven't gotten into the really deep stuff, which is Saudi Arabia and Donald Trump. Stick around. We're going to talk about that. And we'll take your calls on pretty much anything we're talking about here. And welcome back. There's a few other things here in the news. The Veterans Affairs Diversity Chief, excuse me, her name was Georgia Coffey. And she's a career senior executive, was, at the Veterans. She now works for Lockheed Martin. She resigned in disgust over this event. But this is consequential. She's a career senior executive of the Veterans Administration. And when Donald Trump came out and said that there's some very fine people among the Nazis in Virginia and in Charlottesville, the head of the VA came out and said he was horrified by Trump's statement, or words to that effect. And so she was asking the Department of Veterans Affairs to issue a forceful condemnation, not of Trump, but of the Nazis. Just to say, you know, we here at the VA, which, by the way, 40% of their employees, there's 380,000 people who work for the Veterans Administration, 40% of them are minorities. To say, we here at the VA are not happy with, Nazis marching in our streets. We don't think Nazis marching in our streets is a good thing. We don't think there's very fine people among the Nazis. And when she proposed this, that the VA should say this, the VA fought back and said, no, we're not going to say that. And you're not going to say that. And they essentially punished her. And so she left. Olyat, he's her boss, said... Trying to find his first name here. Olyat told Coffey to stand down, the emails show. A person familiar with their dispute who spoke on the condition of anonymity told the Post that Olyat was enforcing a directive from the White House. So the White House tells the VA to shut that woman up who's talking about, we don't like Nazis here at the Veterans Administration. And this is in today's Washington Post. So we have that. And then also Mark Lamont Hill. This is, you know, he's an academic, an activist, a media personality. He's a commentator on CNN. He's African-American. He was given the honor of addressing the United Nations at their commemoration of the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people. And in his closing words, he said that we need to support Palestinian freedom, quote, from the river to the sea, which means basically all across Israel. And is effectively saying, you know, no more apartheid, let's have a two-state solution. Which, you know, most reasonable people have been calling for a long, long time. And what did CNN do? They fired him. This is, you know, the tail end. There's a great piece about this in the today's Washington Post by Noura Erekat. A long history of African Americans who dare to speak out on international issues, basically being stepped on. From Paul Robeson in 1956, being dragged before the House Un-American Affairs Committee. 1967, blacklisting Muhammad Ali over his opposition to the Vietnam War. To Andrew Young, whose wife I knew. She was amazing. Andrew Young, African-American mayor of Atlanta, became the first black U.S. UN ambassador from the United States. And when he informally met with the PLO, the Israelis went crazy and Young was removed. Our first black UN representative. It's amazing. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. I was just talking about the Mark Lamont Hill was fired from CNN for speaking to the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people at the United Nations, which is a great honor, actually. But he called for, you know, the establishment of a two-state solution, basically. And you don't do that, apparently. Meanwhile, over at the VA, the Department of Veterans Affairs, Georgia Coffey, also African-American, a career senior executive at the VA. She's now working for Lockheed Martin because of this. After the Charlottesville thing, she wanted to say, you know, the VA doesn't stand with Nazis. And the White House contacted her boss and said, shut that woman up, which they did, apparently. So anyhow, I mentioned Saudi Arabia. This is a big deal. I think this is a really big deal, actually, you know, something we all need to be paying attention to. And Saudi-funded lobbyists paid for 500 rooms at Donald Trump's hotel after the 2016 election. You've probably heard that one. Well, it gets worse. In fact, it gets a whole lot worse. Tim Hogan over on Twitter is talking about this. He's talking about how could a meeting with the Emiratis and Flynn make the Russia deal worse than you think? Well, it turns out that there was this like super win-win-win that apparently Jared Kushner and Mike Flynn came up with. Jared Kushner needed $1 billion to bail out his building in New York, 666 Fifth Avenue. Jared needed $1 billion. The Saudis wanted plutonium. They wanted to build a nuclear bomb. The Russians wanted the sanctions lifted. And so Flynn and Kushner hatched this scheme that the Saudis and the Emiratis are the ones who eventually gave $1 billion to Kushner to bail out his, I don't know, it was exactly $1 billion, but gave him a pile of money to bail out his building. The Emiratis and the Saudis and the Russians and Kushner and Flynn hatched this scheme where the United States would eliminate the sanctions on Russia. Russia and the American nuclear industry, which is a big funder of the Republican Party, would collaborate on building nuclear power plants in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. And the Saudis and the folks at the UAE would no longer have to operate under the rules that said that if you're running a nuclear power plant, you can't take the plutonium that is created by that power plant. Plutonium is basically a waste material from nuclear power plants. And it's used to make, you know, the very worst kind of nuclear bombs. That right now, if you've got nuclear power in most countries in the world, you're forbidden by law from taking that plutonium out and putting it into nuclear bombs unless you've signed all these treaties with the UN and everything. Well, which is what how we do it and how the Russians do it. But their idea was, hey, let's even do away with all the treaty stuff and just say, you guys want to build a nuclear bomb? No problem. Which would nuclearize, I realize the Israelis already have nukes, but this would heavily nuclearize the Middle East. I mean, what could possibly go wrong? Jared Kushner gets his billion, the Russians get the sanctions done away with, the Emiratis and the Saudis get their nuclear bombs. And so you combine that with the fact that, just weeks after Donald Trump was inaugurated, before he was inaugurated, the Saudis were pouring hundreds of thousands of dollars into Trump properties. So that Trump makes his first overseas visit, which is traditionally is to Canada for the U.S. president, makes it to Saudi Arabia.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
I mean, it's like they're not even covering this. They're not even hiding this stuff. They're skywriting it. We'll pick up your calls after the break. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. This is interesting. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says that she is going to pay her interns $15 an hour. The interns at a lot of the Senate and House offices are paid nothing, zero. Sometimes they get a stipend, $5 an hour or something like that. But, she's saying, this isn't right. We're going to pay people. We're actually going to pay people. If you tried calling in the last little bit, we've been having some problems with our phones. Ashura is rebooting them right now. So it'll take, a minute or two, and then you can call back in and we can get you on the air if you'd like. This whole Saudi nuclear thing, this I find just absolutely astonishing. Tim Hogan is tweeting about this, Tim in Honolulu. And he starts out in this tweet storm saying, how could meeting with the Emiratis and Flynn, Russia, be a lot worse than you think? Well, it's really about, he says, it's really about selling plutonium to the Gulf states. He says, Flynn's deal is going to create lots of spent fuel that is the source of plutonium. And in fact, he references an actual Newsweek article that goes into some detail on this. Again, this is not a secret. It's just like nobody's talking about it. Rachel Maddow reported on the Newsweek story last year. I guess she forgot the Seychelles was about building reactors. Now, this is the media in Seychelles. This involved Eric Prince, Betsy DeVos's brother, the billionaire private army guy, and Mike Flynn. And he says, my thread makes the case that for being what Comey was originally referring to as an active counterintelligence operation, he should get life in prison. Say what, Shira? Oh, Neo Screener? Okay, thank you.
Try that one.
Okay. We're back. We're bringing our phone system back up here. Also, he says, back to Flynn, he was literally Erdogan's secret agent. Erdogan yearned to be the Sultan of the new Ottoman Empire. And then, so Sultan Erdogan's secret agent set up a plan for the Arab states to go in the plutonium manufacturing business. The whole thing is fascinating. I encourage you to go check it out over on Twitter. It's Tim in Honolulu. And then Sally Yates. On January 26th, Sally Yates warned of Michael Flynn's misleading statement about contacting the Russian ambassador and about lying to Pence. Okay, did she know about this meeting when she spoke to Don McGahn, when she warned them? Did the Trump team know about it? I mean, there's some interesting questions here. There's some very interesting questions there. So anyhow, Andy in Columbus, Ohio, listening on WGRN. Hey, Andy, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I wonder your opinion on something. I think I have a way that could prove effective in improving our safe gun laws here in the United States, but it would be pretty much organizing a boycott against the United States in some fashion. Is that against the law, or do people get in trouble for that? Or I heard you talking about earlier, a few minutes ago, people speaking truth to power and getting in trouble for it.
Yeah.
I just wonder what your opinion was on boycotts against.
No, it's not illegal in the United States. It is okay. In Israel, but it's not here. And tourism is a huge industry in the United States. I mean, it's one of the fourth or fifth largest industries, I think, or at least was back when I was in the travel agency business. That was a long time ago.
I don't know if I mentioned that to your screener, but that's exactly the field I was thinking of.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to go into it because I like to keep my ideas to myself so they keep their power. But I appreciate your opinion on that. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. But here's the thing. I don't know how you would organize something like that. I don't know how you'd make it work. And that said, it's already kind of happening. I mean, we have a situation right now where, you know, Trump's visa stuff has discouraged a lot of people from coming to the United States. His trade war with China, Chinese travel to the United States was huge. It's diminished substantially. More and more foreign students are choosing not to go to, now this isn't tourism, but it's a variation, not to go to universities and colleges here in the United States. I mean, there's this whole stack of things that problematically all add up to a loss of tourism dollars and inbound dollars. I don't know about actually going after the travel industry itself. I think that the world can see what's going on, Andy. The world is horrified by this.
I wouldn't use the word boycott. I wouldn't make it a hard sell. It would be like a friendly guy from the United States maybe sending a letter to every major newspaper in the world and saying, hey, we need your help here. And I just want you to be aware of how dangerous it is with our gun laws and other things here. You may want to think twice or maybe three times before coming here to go to school or visit or whatever.
Yeah. Well, I think people already have that message. And
I do too.
And I don't know of any organization that would, organize around kind of let's shoot ourselves in the foot here. Let's hurt America by complaining about what the Trump administration is doing. He's already hurting America enough, frankly.
I was going to say, what do billionaires do every day, Tom?
Yeah, and tourism is a good thing because, you know, when Americans interact with people from other countries, it broadens it opens their mind a little bit. And when tourists come here, they realize that, you know, we're not all Trump. And, so I wouldn't want to just kill off tourism altogether. Yeah.
So, no, I wouldn't either, but I appreciate your thoughts on it. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Andy. Thanks for the call. Interesting thought. So, Saudi Arabia, this is the thing that we're learning about Donald Trump, I believe, and I think this is real, I think this is true, is that if you're a foreign government and you want to have influence over the policy of the United States, give money to Donald Trump. Just that simple. By the way, this is not a new set of rules. It's new for the United States, but it's not a new set of rules. This is how the Philippines has been run for decades. This is how Indonesia is run. It's how Malaysia is run. It's how, you know, parts of much of India is run. It's how, it's how Bangladesh is run. You know, pick your third world country, right? If you want to do business, you've got to get in tight with the guy who runs the country. And the Saudis figured that out, and they just threw all kinds of money at Donald Trump in the first few weeks of his presidency. And what does he decide to do? The first overseas visit he makes is to Saudi Arabia. Brian in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Brian, what's on your mind?
Hey, thanks for taking my call so quickly. I just called.
Sure.
But the guy was talking there about tourism, and you were saying you weren't quite sure if tourism is down. It seems like it was. Well, I work in tourism. I've been working for the last 4.5 years in taking passengers to Cuba legally through the people-to-people cultural exchange.
Oh, cool.
And it used to be cool for about 4.5 years. And now this season, which is November through May normally, I have zero trips. Because
Louise and I went on one of those last year or maybe it was very early this year. Early spring of this year, we went to Cuba. In fact, I think it was February or March, and it was we went with Code Pink, and it was just an absolutely wonderful trip. I mean, it's just the most amazing country. The people are wonderful. I was so impressed. I'm assuming you've been there, Brian.
Yeah, 23 times over the 4.5 years.
Wow.
And I, You probably don't have the time to give me to go into why we should be friends with Cuba at this point.
Go for it.
Not enemies. But,
go for it. I would love to hear your opinion on. You know, I developed some fairly strong opinions about that when I was down there. You know, I think we have far more in common with Cuba than we have in opposition to them. You know, it's not a tin pot dictatorship like, say, Saudi Arabia. You know, it's like. But well, anyhow, make your argument.
Well, I mainly wanted to call about tourism. I've lost my Cuba work, but also my friends that work in the inbound industry, like people coming to America, they're suffering as well because Europeans and Australians and who have money are like, you know what? I don't want to go to America this year or next year. I don't like Donald Trump. Forget it. So that's suffering, but as well because of Donald Trump. But in terms of Cuba, sorry, I didn't think I was making this argument, so I'm trying to put my thoughts together. We vastly misunderstand, most Americans vastly misunderstand what Fidel Castro did and did not do.
Correct.
Now, would I like to make out that he's a saint and he did everything right? Of course not, but along the way he gave people health care and education and, you know...
And housing.
Medicine, access to medicine, healthcare and stuff. So he gave them some things along the way. And I think most Americans think if you went to Cuba and said, do you hate Fidel, who's gone, of course, but do you hate Fidel and would you like to get out of from under his thumb and move to America and be American tomorrow? Most Americans would go like, of course, Fidel's a horrible dictator. But the answer is not that. You know, it's much more... It's much more gray than it is black and white. And we, you know, does everybody love everything their leaders have always done? Of course not. I mean, we know that better than anybody right now, as well as anybody right now.
Right.
But we're at a crossroads with them. We don't need to be enemies with them. We have complicated relationships with so many countries that we used to be antagonistic with, but they're right on our doorstep. And if we don't go in, I mean, just from a cynical strategic point of view, if we don't make friends with them, someone else will and already is. China's already getting the money.
I was just about to say, Chinese container ships are starting to pull into the docks in Havana.
Yes. There's no reason for us to make the same mistake twice. And Trump doesn't even do much about Cuba. He doesn't care. He doesn't know about Cuba. I mean, he tried to.
Well, you know what is driving this is the whole Marco Rubio type. You know, it's like you've got these Cubans who were very, very, or you've got these Americans, well, in some cases Cubans as well, who were very, very wealthy before Castro came along, and they were tied into Batista, and they were tied into the mafia because the mafia owned Cuba, basically, for all practical purposes. And Batista was their guy, or vice versa. And as a consequence of that, those are the families who fled Cuba when Castro took over and thought, someday I'll get my money back. You see these palatial mansions all around Havana, you know, just beautiful houses that have been now turned into, you know, they've been broken out so the individual, you know, floors or rooms are now, you know, owned by or rented by people. But they were once the property of, like, Marco Rubio's family kind of thing. And these rich Cubans who you know, thought this was going to be their retirement and everything, they're saying, you know, we want to go back and take our property back, and that's never going to happen. And as that generation that still thinks they have property there dies off and their children are getting it, no, you know, that property is long ago appropriated by the government and, you know, it's been given to the people of Cuba now. I don't think this is going to last more than another generation, Brian. Brian?
Rubio's origin story is he claims that his parents... fled the oppression of Castro, and that's his whole origin story and why he gets so much street cred with the Cuban Americans in Miami. His parents, and this isn't really debated, his parents came to America in May, I believe, I don't know what month, but early 1956. Castro didn't even go back to Cuba from Mexico until late 1956. Now, his story now has now that people have called him on it, his story is like, well, yes, but they went back there a couple times to see if they could move back. But his main original story that they fled Castro's oppression isn't actually true. But he still more or less sticks like that if no one calls him on it.
Amazing. Brian, thanks a lot for the call. And to anybody watching or listening, there's some great people-to-people programs going to Cuba. Brian, do you have a website for yours?
Well, the company I was working for is called International Expedition.
And they're still doing these trips? Are they trying to?
Well, they don't have any on the
books for this year.
Because,
yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And Code Pink was doing them too. I don't know if they still are. Brian, thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with more of the news of the day right after this. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Donald Trump, this is probably the thing that is more accurately illustrates, is the word illustrative or illustrative? I don't know. It's these words that I've read my whole life and I've never heard anybody actually say out loud. But this actually illustrates, I think, the mentality of Donald Trump more than anything else I can think of. And President Donald Trump was taken to task on Twitter after a report claimed he shrugged off surging U.S. national debt because it wouldn't happen until he leaves the White House. Seriously. The Daily Beast tweeted this out in early 2017 when senior officials offered Trump charts and graphics. See, they have to do it in pictures for Donald. You can't write something down because he really doesn't read very well, as you can see when he's struggling to read a teleprompter. In early 2017, when senior officials, again, this is in the Daily Beast, when senior officials offered Trump charts and graphics laying out the numbers and showing a hockey stick spike in national debt in the not-too-distant future, Trump's response was, "Yeah, but I won't be here." Now, first of all, how did that hockey stick come about? And secondly, you know, how did people respond to Trump saying, "Yeah, but I won't be here"? The hockey stick comes about because you have the national debt, but you also have the interest that you have to pay on the national debt. Our national debt is now $21 trillion. If we're paying 2% interest on that, that's what bonds are paying, on $20 trillion, that would be $400 billion a year in interest payments that we're making. But if the Fed, you know, if the rate that the treasuries are paying goes up, as it historically has, I mean, the historic average is around 5%. So if it goes up to 5% on $20 trillion of debt, you're paying $1 billion a year in interest. And, you know, if we can't afford to pay that $1 billion a year in interest, then we borrow it and our debt becomes $22 trillion. And the next year, the debt is $22 trillion and we owe, you know, $1.2 trillion or $1 billion. Can't afford that, we roll it into the debt. You know, and it's like this, and that's how it starts really amplifying. That when we reach the point where, I mean, right now, our interest payments on the national debt are about half of what we pay for the Pentagon. That's a massive amount of money. It's more than all the federal spending in the United States on social welfare programs, exempting the healthcare programs. If you take out Medicare, Medicaid, and those kind of programs, we are spending more on the national debt than we're spending on human beings in the United States, period. Now, I've not been a debt hawk, you know, throughout my life. I'm not one of those who get hysterical about the national debt. But, you know, this is crazy, the way that Trump is doing this. Another person, Trump say, "Yeah, I won't be here when it happens." Another person tweeted, Keith Boykin tweeted, "This also appears to be his philosophy on climate change." Mike Madden tweets, "Probably should not come as a surprise to learn that a longtime real estate developer whose companies have declared bankruptcy multiple times is not that worried about long-term debt." And at Bunch tweets, "Breaking, man who bankrupted 4 businesses not concerned with unsustainable debt." Right. We'll be back with your calls and more of the news of the day right after this. Stick around. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. So are your friends figuring out that the Republican Party is a scam? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. Dean in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Dean, you wanted to talk about tariffs?
I do, yes, Tom. First, you're my guru. Been listening to you for many years. But over the years, I've heard you and Bernie both speak about the need for tariffs. And now that Trump has instituted them, it seems like everybody is not happy about it. I'm just wondering why that is. What's happening?
Okay. In simple form, it's because Trump is doing them stupidly. The idea of tariffs is you want to make foreign goods more expensive than domestically manufactured goods, right? That's the simple idea. Alexander Hamilton laid it out in 1791 to Congress. They enacted tariffs in 1793, and we had tariffs of 1793 right through into really the Reagan started cutting them radically, and then Clinton cut them more, and you know now we pretty much don't have tariffs. And what that did was it built our country. Tariffs provided 100% of the federal revenue from the founding of the Republic until the Civil War. They provided 50% of all federal revenue from the Civil War to World War I. And they provided 30% of federal revenue from World War I to World War II. So they were very consequential in the rise of the modern American industrial base. And when the Chinese started using tariffs about 25 years ago, and they were using other things in addition to tariffs to protect, you know, basically protectionist things like, you know, the Chinese content rules and, you know, things have to be made in a particular way. The Europeans do this with cars, right? You know, the way that the mirror is attached has to be unique to Europe. It's functionally a tariff. And what it did was it built China. I mean, tariffs built China. And so Trump is right that we need tariffs. And this is traditionally, up until 1992, when Bill Clinton abandoned them, this was the position of the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party was, you know, always in favor of tariffs all the way back to when Thomas Jefferson founded it. And the Republican Party at various times has been in favor of tariffs too. You know, Dwight Eisenhower oversaw average probably 25 to 30% tariffs on, you know, broadly speaking, against all goods. The problem is, if you're saying, essentially, when the government puts a tariff on something, if we put, China put a 40% tariff on American cars, that was their way of saying to Chinese manufacturers, manufacture in China because you'll be able to sell your cars here in China for 40% less, which is what China did. The problem here in the United States is that because we've been without tariffs for about 20 years, broadly speaking. I mean, we still have over 20,000 tariff categories, and our average tariffs are around 1%. So they're still there, and they could be raised back up to 20 or 30%, which is our average for our first 200 years of history. The problem is that you're basically saying to American car manufacturers, for example, don't manufacture overseas because when you ship that car back into the United States for sale, it's going to cost more. If you manufacture it here, it'll cost less. And that, which makes perfect sense. And so a company would say, okay, we'll invest $1 billion in a new factory because we just got this, you know, billion-dollar tax break. The problem is that these tariffs that Trump is doing, he's using national security as the excuse for. Our national security laws allow the president to place tariffs on sensitive goods in order to discourage the sale of those goods or the purchase of those goods, either one, you know, basically to block something that might be used by another country that's a hostile power. And he's using that law to impose these tariffs, which means that when he leaves office in 2 years, those tariffs are going to go away. Now, if you're General Motors, are you going to make a $1 billion bet by building a factory in the United States that the tariffs are going to stay when that's the case? I mean, tariffs have to be enacted by Congress, not by the president. That's my point. Does that make sense, Dean? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do understand what you're saying.
So,
thank you.
Yeah, the net of this is that, you know, tariffs are a good thing, but they need to be done systematically. They need to be done methodically. They need, you know, this whole experiment, this neoliberal experiment with global free trade has been a disaster for country after country. It's why France is melting down right now. It's why China is so powerful right now. It's, you know, basically the manufacturing and the jobs associated with the manufacturing in the United States and in parts of Europe have just gone to China. And it's because of the end of tariffs. Dean, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. It's coming up on 57 minutes past the hour. Professor Richard Wolff will be with us right after the top of the hour. We're going to be talking about capitalism, the economy, the market, all that cool stuff. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartmann.